Welcome to Chatting About Change with Dr. Jim Maddox. I'm a professor, OD consultant, and change strategist, helping individuals and organizations experience life to the fullest and engaging in positive transformational change. In addition to this podcast, please check out my latest book, Embracing Resistance to Change, Facilitating Change Differently Through the Paradox of Resistance, available now through Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. Hello and welcome to another episode of Chatting About Change with Dr. Jim Maddox. Today I'm visiting with Catherine Getzke, who is just an extraordinary human being. She's an entrepreneur. She is a change agent, changing the world. She is all about hope. And so I'm just going to let her tell a little bit of her amazing story, because the introduction really wouldn't do it justice. So welcome, Catherine.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so great to be here. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So hope, tell us about how did you become and tell us about the program that you're bringing to schools and to communities.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, you can pretty much say I'm obsessed with hope. Like, I think it's a pretty fair statement. And I started my journey, actually started in business about 20 years. I worked for a number of companies in marketing and branding, and launched products and worked in advertising and did some rebranding projects. And about 20 years ago, I launched my own brand called Moonlights. And we did the first nationwide cause marketing campaign for mental health, ended up getting my brand in Lowe's Home Improvement, and raised some money. So I had a nonprofit as well, raised some money for the charity, and got really engaged in the global mental health space and wanted to do a suicide prevention program. And they were talking about suicide prevention at the time, like restricting access to means, which is, you know, guns or pesticides or an 800 number. And I thought, you know, that's not really prevention. That's addressing something in a time of crisis. And so if you want to prevent suicide, how do you do it? And hopelessness across the literature is a single consistent predictor of suicide, and not just suicide, but violence. All violence is really stems from hopelessness, a sense of emotional despair and motivational helplessness. And so I said, well, I got to figure out how to get to hope. Like, how can we learn how to be hopeful? Why haven't I been taught that? And how can we do that? And so I set out on a journey to really study that, to figure out. They were measuring hope at the time. So it was like, can you teach someone how to be hopeful? And we were able to prove that you can. And as you increase someone's hope, their anxiety and depression decreases. So it's pretty extraordinary. So yeah, I've been now obsessed with figuring out how to teach everyone. So all populations, using an evidence-based approach. So something that's actually got science behind it that can be validated. I'm really excited about it. Excited about where we are now.
Where are some of the communities that you launched your program?
Well, initially I started with focusing, like, really, you know, studying the idea, can we teach hope? So I created a program initially for 7 to 11 year olds, and I studied in Malaysia and Northern Ireland and Suriname. So we put kids through this program, started with 10 weeks, then 12, and now 16. But we're able to show that, yes, as we increased hope in them, anxiety and depression decreased. So I made that my big dream and goal was to have an evidence-based global program that kids could access to learn how to be hopeful. And so we kind of achieved that. And then, you know, once we started really activating that, that's been used, I think, in 48 countries around the world, over 5,000 educators.
Integrated into the school system?
Well, educators can download it and then integrate it in their classroom. So it's all scripted. So we don't need to go and train and do anything on it. It's scripted. They read the lessons, and there's a workbook that kids can do. So we have an overview program that's 3 lessons. We have a deep dive program that's 16 lessons for young kids. And we have a parent's guide so parents can start using hope language at home. And, you know, really work to build this out, a really robust program around hope. And then my mayor at the time, Mayor Hillary Sheehy in Reno, Nevada, she's now president of the Conference of Mayors. So she's really active in the mental health space. said, why don't you do something for cities like they do for kindness? And so a couple of years ago, I set out to figure out how could you activate hope throughout a city? And we came up with six areas that we want to influence. So the government, education, science, art, awareness, so like really marketing and branding, and then business, workplaces. And so we have a Hopeful Cities playbook now that we're working to activate cities around the science of hope. And, you know, the message being primarily that we learn how to be hopeless and we've got to learn how to be hopeful. So, you know, there are a lot of things that kind of teach us hopelessness. And we've got now 57% of our teen girls identify with persistent hopelessness. And yeah, I mean, and it's, I mean, 57% of our teen girls, you know, persistently hopeless, and it's learned. And so they're learning to be hopeless from us and the media and all of that. And we've got to counteract that with skills to be hopeful. And yeah.
So what are some of the skills or what are some of the ways to activate?
Yeah.
And then I want to come back to how many countries you've launched your programs in. Have you seen, how is it different from different cultures?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll address both of those. So, I'm chief hope officer at the Shine Hope Company. So,
I love that. The Shine Hope.
The Shine Hope. So we created Shine is the mnemonic. So that's really fundamentally how we now teach hope. So we teach stress skills, happiness habits, inspired actions, nourishing networks, and eliminating challenges, which are thinking patterns that get in the way of our ability to hope. And so when I go in and train workplaces on hope, I really use that Shine framework. And the Shine framework is throughout all of our programming. So now I've developed, you know, we have this K through really 8 programming. And I have a teen program that I'm launching that uses the Shine framework where teens, it's a peer-to-peer teaching where they teach each other through exercises and learning a little bit and then discussions. I have a 10-module college course now that's evidence-based that we're licensing to colleges around hope. And then the workplace campaigns that we do, I train workplaces leadership around hope, I teach managers around hope, do employee activations, but it all uses this common Shine framework and language around kind of how we're teaching hope. Which takes me to your second question. It's really what the cool thing is, hope is a pretty universal construct. So I've studied it around the world and, you know, they might adapt the stories, some of the stories they tell, but it's really universally understood and it's universally necessary. I did some work in Northern Ireland and we did it in integrated colleges. And, you know, in the history of Northern Ireland, they not too long ago were killing their neighbors because of, you know, their religion. So Catholics versus Protestants. So they have now what are called these integrated colleges where they use a lot of our hope programming, but the country overall has really adopted a lot of it. I've studied it because that was important to me too. I mean, can we create something that's universal that can be accessible anywhere in the world? And so right now our programming's in English. We have some Spanish workbooks, but it's primarily English and people can translate it to their, you know, dialect if they want to do that in the specific countries. But
it's almost, you know, when I think about the construct of hope, it's almost like we're kind of in a, I'll use the word pandemic because we just came out of a pandemic or we're still kind of on the tail end of it.
Yeah.
We're almost in a pandemic of hopelessness.
Absolutely. Yeah, we are. I mean, I think it's, you know, and to me, we're, especially with our youth, we're telling them there's something wrong with them when they're sad. We're, you know, they think, oh, I'm depression, I have an illness, or I'm afraid, and so I have anxiety. But really, it's learning how to kind of positively manage our emotions so that we're not harming the self and we're not harming other people. And we're not learning how to do that. So we're kind of over-identifying with our hopelessness. And I mean, our political system is so divided now that it's like the system itself is it's like really driven with hopelessness because we, you know, it's just so divided. And so when you look at hopelessness, it's, you know, it doesn't mean something. We all experience hopelessness all the time. So, and people say, well, not me, but really when you think about hopelessness overall, it's fundamentally just emotional despair. So you're angry, you're sad, or you're afraid. which we all experience, you know, moments of this throughout the day, and you feel helpless to do anything about it. So it's really that combination of emotional despair and motivational helplessness. And so it's learning how to manage those moments of hopelessness. If we get cut off in traffic, if someone says something to us that we don't like or is unkind, if, you know, we get an unexpected bill in the mail, there's a lot of things that can trigger these hopeless moments. And some of them are bigger than others. And I lost my dad. My dad died by suicide when I was 18 years old. And that triggered, you know, it was a big moment of hopelessness for me. And I managed it in all of the ways that are not healthy. I mean, in a number of ways that are unhealthy, that really just drove me deeper into despair and helplessness, as opposed to really identifying what the despair is about, getting support for that and the helplessness, and learning how to go from helplessness to back to kind of inspired action. So yeah, it's the positive thing for me, and the thing, you know, is that once, especially with our youth, once they understand, well, you've learned, of course you're experiencing hopelessness. This is normal. And this is how you get to hope, but it's up to you. You know, the self efficacy about that is so important, and empowering teens and youth with skills to kind of navigate their hopelessness so they don't get stuck into an anxiety or a depressive disorder or something like that. But that just, you know, hopelessness is a normal part of life. How do we navigate it in a way that's healthy for ourselves and where we're not harming ourselves or other people?
Yeah, and those big events like that. I mean, it can be the big events like that, but it's also those little daily things.
Absolutely, that add up. And, you know, you look at, I use the what happened at the Oscars as an example with Will Smith. And the first thing we teach is how to identify and manage our stress response. Because when we're triggered by things externally in our environment, we get this rushing of adrenaline, norepinephrine, and we go into what we tell our kids is our downstairs brain. We tell it to adults too, but very simply.
Yeah, I've heard it called the wizard brain.
Yes.
Yeah, the downstairs.
Downstairs, brain. Yeah. And we can't be downstairs and upstairs at the same time. And the upstairs is when we're creative, collaborative, problem solving. You know, that's where we get to the answers of whatever it is we hope for in life. And so he was triggered and he was in his downstairs brain. Well, it takes 90 seconds for those chemicals to cycle through our body. So any decision you make within that 90 seconds is usually going to be a really bad decision, especially if you're super triggered. And that can impact everything in your life, everything that you've worked so hard to build, everything that you've worked so hard to do. So to me, if we can all, like, number one, the first thing, just learn how to manage that stress response and understand the biology of what's happening too, because we may not have a lot of control over our actions, but what we can control is just being still. And silence and breathing until we get through that 90 second, you know, space and time to when we can be, just make a healthier decision about what we want to do. They say most crimes are committed between the time, the thought and the action, in under 30 seconds. And you think about that. And what if everyone learned how to stop in that, you know, in that time and wait that 90 seconds? So that's why that's really the first key.
It's like the parents thing of when you're mad, count to 10.
Right. Yeah. But it's 90.
90. Yeah. 90 seconds. That's,
which is a long,
minute and a half. That's a long time. If you just sit.
I know.
You can hold your breath for 90. It'd be hard to hold your breath for 90 seconds.
No, you don't. You want to breathe. You want to breathe because that's going to calm down your nervous system a bunch and improve your heart rate variability and all of those things that are helpful in those periods.
So, yeah. So the real key is getting that for them to recognize that they're being
triggered.
That they're triggered.
Yeah. And just learning, your response of wanting to punch someone or whatever you want to do is like, that might be healthy, but that might feel better in the moment. It releases endorphins and these positive hormones, but it's not going to be healthy for you long term. So learn how to sit through that until those chemicals cycle through you. So there's a great book on it. Mm-hmm.
That's the S part, right? That's
the
managing the stress.
And like, what a different world if everyone in the world just knew how to do that alone. But that's, you know, that's what the SHINE framework is about. It's about these skills. And the thing is, we expect kids to behave, but we don't teach them these things. And when they do something wrong, instead of trying to understand why we tell them shame on you, or you did this, and we don't tell them why they might be doing these, acting out in these ways. And why, I mean, to me, violence is actually, if you've got a kid and constant trauma or in despair, violence can feel good, so that's actually kind of a smart response for a kid if they're in like a lot of pain, because it releases endorphins and internally, and from a biological standpoint, that feels better than where they are in that moment. But if you
can, there's something motivating them to
absolutely that, yeah,
externally it's a very negative behavior, very right. harmful to others,
right,
and it's self-destructive to them, but it's goal directed.
Absolutely. And until they learn that and then learn other skills, that other things that can actually produce those similar hormones, but that are actually healthy for them, will serve them long term. Like, how can we expect our kids to act differently or to, and that's really our teen program is about teaching them all of these things, so that, and letting them discuss it among themselves. So teaching the biology of what's happening and the science behind it, and letting them kind of make decisions that are healthy for them, but looking at like, what are the healthy things that release dopamine, and what are the unhealthy things that release dopamine, and what am I doing more of, and how can I come up with new ways to get the dopamine or, endorphins that I need, that aren't going to harm myself, or other people. But again, like, we don't teach them this. And so how do we have all of these expectations? They're going to behave in all of these ways unless we teach them. And
so they need the knowledge
yeah.
of what's going on.
Right.
And then they need to have the self-awareness.
Yeah.
And then they need to have some skill of what to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then they need the support of other people working together to do it.
It reminds me of like when a child is learning to walk.
Yeah.
They get so much encouragement.
Yeah.
Even when they fall,
yeah,
they get cheered on,
yeah,
they get helped back up,
yeah,
and
yeah,
they get all this reinforcement,
yes.
And somewhere along the line, we start punishing kids mm-hmm. for not being successful the first time.
Absolutely.
And so, if we treated it like learning to walk,
because
if we treated kids learning to walk the way we teach them later on,
yeah,
a few years later,
yeah,
hardly any babies would learn to walk. It's sad to think of. I mean, maybe they would succeed despite their parenting.
Right. Yeah. But,
so that's, so absolutely. Let's go through the SHINE acronym.
Yeah.
I think that's just, anytime you can have something like that, it's really, really powerful. One thing that I wanted to throw back to the basement brain or the downstairs brain. It really reminds me of like Viktor Frankl in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, where he talks about between stimulus and response.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that pause.
Yeah.
And that's what makes us human. That's where we have a choice.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I read a lot of, his book, like a lot of those books to understand, because, I lost my dad to suicide. I had my own attempt in my 20s. And so I said, if I want to stay alive, like, I have to learn, like, from the people that have been through really horrendous things, and how did they, what were the skills they used, like, how did they, and so that was a big influence on, just thinking about being in that camp and being with all of that systemic oppression around me, and how easy it would be to give up, and so what kind of separates the people that don't give up, the people that give up. And so learning that, and with my dad too, I think that, it was definitely hopelessness, like he could have been diagnosed with whatever, but I think fundamentally, and for myself too, I identify most with just an inability to manage my hopelessness. So I couldn't manage my despair, and I couldn't manage my helplessness, and I needed tools and skills and kind of a roadmap for doing that. My dad was horrible at managing his stress response, and he destroyed a lot of things in his life because of his inability to manage his stress response. But what we didn't know at the time was the biology of it, really what was happening. And so we just tell him to stop getting angry, but that doesn't really help with someone that has, that gets triggered and has this physiological, like, I saw his physiology change. Like, I saw it, but he didn't have any access to where he could, problem solve or be clear or talk to me in a healthy way when he was, triggered in that way and in his downstairs brain. And it, from him, it came from a lot of trauma in his childhood that he hadn't really addressed. But, you know, again, it's learning skills to kind of navigate that and taking, you know, to me, bringing the biology of it into the equation helps take a lot of the blame off and like understanding the biology and what biology and what's happening so that we can then get a better handle on how to kind of manage it, because it's having a supportive environment with people that help us manage it as well, identify it, manage it. I had a kid in Northern Ireland that had gone through our program and said, you know, I got in a car with my brother and we used to fight like crazy. And he said, I saw, you know, I got in the car, I noticed my brother was agitated. He said something and his normal response would be to just engage with his brother. And he said, but I noticed my brother was in his downstairs brain. And so instead of, you know, I just took a step back and I just kind of rode home. I took a shower and we got up the next day and everything, you know, it was fine. It was like nothing happened. And he said, our whole relationship changed because of that knowledge.
You didn't engage.
Right. Yeah. And it would panic me growing up with my dad. When my dad was in his downstairs, I just want to fix it, you know, and that's not necessarily the most, you know, letting that cycle through, that time cycle through is a very important part of understanding that stress response.
Yeah. And if you don't, that quick, you get reinforced then for that quick
overreaction. Yeah.
And then that becomes your learned pattern.
Yes.
Okay. That's how I cope with being triggered is I react instead of responding.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah. So I come back full circle. I kind of went off on a tangent. So the SHINE acronym.
Yeah. So H is the happiness habits, and that's cultivating those healthy long-term habits that really help promote the positive hormones that we experience, the endorphins and serotonin. And so, you know,
so what are some happiness habits?
Nutrition, a morning routine is really important. A gratitude practice, you know, singing, dancing, it can playing sports. It can be different from, but sleep, nutrition, and, yeah, it can be different for different people. Watching funny videos, like smiling releases endorphins. And so if you're in a really horrible mood, even just looking in the mirror and smiling, I mean, that's like, which is, it's when you don't want to do it, you know, but that's when it's extra important to practice those happiness habits. So when we have experienced times of great stress, we often stop doing things that bring us joy and release those positive. And that's when we need to be doing it the most. You know, when we have too much stress, too many stress hormones in our body, it becomes very toxic. And so, you know, I added to after the trauma, I added to a lot of those, you know, by doing a lot of things that were super unhealthy for me. So I just got myself even more out of balance and out of whack when I should have been really diligent about my sleep, about everything I put in my body, both nutrition wise and what I was reading and listening to and, you know, the people I was surrounding myself, kind of all of those things. And so, but happiness habits, you know, and to me, I just kind of laughed at them and I didn't understand the importance of gratitude, especially if I was like angry at someone or my partner. You know, I found gratitude to be annoying, but really if you focus on gratitude, you can always find things to be very grateful for and it will change your mindset and your mood and your state. And so it's making those, becoming aware of that and then making an intentional practice out of that and understanding what works for you, you know, is going to be different for someone else. Like part of my happiness habits is time alone in nature, you know, for other people, it might be time with each other in nature or just something else, but, you know, getting clear on what those are and then, and really doubling down on them when you're going through periods of high stress. And then having things that are non-negotiable that you know you have to do regardless of how busy you are in life. Exercise is like, if I'm not exercising every day, I'm like, I've got a problem. So, you know.
Yeah. My therapist, the first thing when I was going through a really rough spot in life, I was seeing him weekly and I miss seeing him. I miss our interactions, but we both have kind of moved on. He's semi-retired and I'm in a different place. But that used to be the first thing he would ask when I would go in and just be like, and he'd be like, tell me one thing that's gone well this week. And I'm like, nothing.
Right.
And then he would say, how many times have you worked out this week? how many times have you written in your gratitude journal?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I didn't do either of those things
because I'm
in the funk. And
right.
And it's like, that's so self-defeating.
I know. I know. And it's so, to me, that was like my comfortable place. That's where I, you know, it felt, and it was just, and it was all learned. Like I didn't know any better, and I didn't know any better through experiencing any better. And so once I started, yeah.
You have to replace some of the unhealthy coping strategies.
Yeah.
With healthy ones.
You do.
And so you've got to unlearn some of those habits.
Yeah.
That, and especially when there's things that happen as a child or a kid.
Yeah.
You come up with the best you can for coping.
Right.
And it might work then, but it's not sustainable.
Right.
And it's not what might be okay at that age becomes unhealthy in later stages.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah. So it's unlearning those habits, but having something to replace it with.
Right. Yeah. And learning what's healthy and what's not healthy. I know. I mean, I started addictive patterns I started smoking cigarettes at a very young age. And to me, it's calmed me down, but it really wasn't in any way, shape or form healthy for me. And it actually didn't help my anxiety and depression. It made all of that, my stress hormones worse and further activated it. And then, you know, learning how to quit was stressful. But I did, I replaced it with running. And I was like, once I learned kind of what it was doing to me in my mid-20s, I was like, I'm going to go work out instead of, and I can still smoke if I want to smoke, but I have to run every day. And I'd go to the gym and I would smell this, like, it was so gross, you know, like I can't even believe now that I used to smoke. It's like, so, you know, but it's, you have to replace it. And I couldn't run, like my lungs hurt so bad from running, but I wanted so much to feel better. And I knew that ultimately this is what would make me feel better. And then learning meditation. So learning meditation was another kind of game changer for me, because I did it in group meditation. And once I had an experience in meditation where I learned to witness an itch, you know, I had an itch and I wanted to just scratch it, but I was in with a group and I'm, you know, every move anyone made, you could feel it in the room.
So learning to sit with it.
So yeah, I was like, what happens if I just observe it? And it was the first time ever that I thought, oh my gosh, I don't have to fix everything immediately that appears. You know, you can just observe something. You can just watch the itch and it just like eventually goes away, you know? So, but those are all things that are learned and you learn through experience. I wish I'd learned them very young, you know?
Yeah. So, you don't know how many times I've said that.
Yeah, I know. Like,
oh.
But that's my goal. So, you know, these are all skills that can be taught. And if you teach kids young, they really integrate and then it becomes a part of who they are. So,
yeah, because those are things that people pick up when they've gone through a crisis.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not always.
And spent a lot. Oh, right. And not always, and don't have access to the information. And I am so fortunate that I've had access to care and I've had access to learning about all of these different things and traveling and learning in different cultures. And to me, I want especially our youth to have access to this, you know, yesterday, because they are training themselves to be hopeless when they need to be training themselves to be hopeful. And the amount of power that comes once you have hope in your life and once you are, you know, committed to your purpose and your passion and you're using those emotions for positive change in the world. I mean, there's such energy behind it, but you know, they've got to be taught the skills and we can't blame anyone but ourselves for teaching them otherwise, really.
So what's the I then? So we got SH.
So the I is inspired actions. And so, you know, there are different researchers in hope, and a lot of the folks in hope look solely at goal direction and having a goal and then having a pathway and then coming up with new pathways and then having the self-efficacy to get there. And so mine is both. When I came up with hope, I really was looking at hopelessness. So how do we get from hopelessness to what I see the opposite is hope? So I looked at both that emotional despair and then the motivational helplessness. And so the inspired action really looks at how do we set goals? How do we overcome obstacles to goals? What are the challenges? So when we're helpless, I mean, helplessness is really around goals, is really around action. And so how do we get from helplessness to inspired actions? And so it's a framework for doing that. Why is it important to set SMART goals and stretch goals and intrinsic goals versus extrinsic goals and positive goals versus negative goals? So we kind of go through the framework. And then, you know, there's cool research on hope that if you visualize something that you want in your future and you visualize an obstacle that might pop up and you visualize yourself overcoming that obstacle, and then you visualize another obstacle and you kind of repeat that process, regardless of if you hit one of those obstacles or a totally different obstacle, you're more likely to achieve the goal just because you've built some self-efficacy before even attempting the goal. And so, you know, we teach a lot of those things in that, you know, when you're stuck, like how do you step? What's the stepping process? So how do you kind of chunk down goals? And why is just taking one step a really good way to get out of helplessness? And things like habit stacking. So, you know, putting a goal that you want to achieve, like adding a habit you want to achieve on top of another habit that you're already doing. That can be a more
effective.
Love that
phrase, habit stacking.
I know, yeah. But it's really powerful. Like if you're already brushing your teeth, say your gratitudes then, like add that habit onto something you're already doing so that it's not a completely like new time and day and, you know, but so yeah, really like, and we're not taught these skills. A lot of us aren't. I mean, some are, but a lot aren't. And so how are we expected to get from helplessness to action unless we're given kind of a toolbox to do that?
That's so cool.
So the N is nourishing networks. And, you know, we talk about loneliness a lot. I fundamentally see it still through a hopelessness framework where like we feel hopeless about the ability to make connections with other people. So what do? We manage our despair around it and we manage our helplessness. So we set new goals about making friends, making connections, kind of all of these things. But nourishing networks are an important part of whatever we hope for in life. I mean, the data on having relationships is very clear, you know, to our happiness, to our well-being, to connecting with others. And, you know, we're not taught that much about healthy relationships versus unhealthy relationships. And we're most like the five people we surround ourselves with. So who are we surrounding ourselves with and how do we add to those networks and really identifying the networks. So we have like in our program with youth, make sure every kid can identify one trusted person they can go to in a time of crisis. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of what we've seen is a lot of our kids, like half of them don't even have a trusted adult in their life that they can go to in time of need. And so, you know, how can we expect those kids to be hopeful? We all need someone to go to. So we make sure that that teacher or the mentor or whomever identifies themselves. But it's a lot about strengthening our networks too and why they're so important and the kind of science behind that. We're up to 95% more likely to achieve a goal if we write it down. And then we check in with someone regularly on the goal. And so that's, you know, to me, whatever you hope for in life, you know, it was a really goal, like, what are your goals? Like, what do you want in life? That's really what hope is all about. And so how do we get there? And so our networks is a very important part of that.
Yeah. And when you go back to like the S part, when we get stressed and we get triggered, we often turn inward.
Yeah.
And isolate ourselves.
Absolutely.
And just do the opposite of growing those networks.
Yeah. Yeah. Or we harm our networks through our, you know, through our responses because we're stressed out. So yeah, learning the importance of that and how to nurture them and like and how to notice when we're in our upstairs and downstairs brain and when they are and how to give space. And
yeah, because when we're in our downstairs brain, we can become very adept at getting other people to go to their downstairs brain.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. I know. Yeah.
I'm in my downstairs brain, so my network is going into their downstairs brain.
Yeah.
I'm going to drag them down with me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And how do we sell healthy boundaries around that? And how do we get support if we're having problems with our sadness or anger or fear? Like talking to a therapist about it, you know, getting professional support and not being like, it's just a normal part of life. We all experience sadness, fear, anger. So there's nothing wrong with that. And it's actually pretty smart if you do that, if you check in with someone. So you're not destroying all of your relationships, but you're getting support, managing it, making goals around it. Yeah, super important.
Cool. And then
the E of the shine. So eliminating challenges. And this is just really all our thinking patterns that get in the way of our ability to be hopeful. So we do things like we ruminate on the past, you know, and we just cycle over and over and over things that we can't change or we can't solve or, you know, just feel bad. You know, that's going to lead us to hopelessness. Worrying about things in the future, you know, a big 95% of the things we worry about never happen. So,
you know, who said that?
Who did?
Yeah. Tom Petty.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that.
In his song Square One.
Uh-huh.
He says, it's interesting that the things I worry about never happen anymore.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. You know, so using our stress skills and happiness habits to get us out of those states when we notice ourselves in those states, internalizing failure, which is a big thing. So we talk a lot now about failure and why failure is important. What we're missing from that conversation is that we internalize failure. So if I fail at something, if I and especially with kids, if they fail at a grade, they think I am a failure. So they identify as a failure, but really it's a process that failed. And so what you want to do is deconstruct that process. What steps did you take to get to that F on your class? Or what steps did you take to break up with your girlfriend? Or what, and how can you do it differently next time? Because that's where your self-efficacy comes in. And so if you can just really use it to learn from it and understand it's not you that's a failure, it's just the process that you took to get to that destination that failed. And so it's learning that and really learning to de-identify from our failures. Trying to control things outside of our control, which is like, I mean, I just watched during the pandemic, I'm like, of course, anxiety and depression are going to go up because our hopelessness. Everyone is persistently hopeless because they're focusing on their despair and helplessness and they're getting in that cycle. And it's like, when you focus on things that you can't control, of course it leads you to helplessness. I mean, that is the definition of helpless. You know, you're trying to have an impact on something you can't have any impact on. And so it gets you into that cycle of hopelessness. And that's when it becomes persistent as when it's a problem. So learning how to, just like when you're having a challenge with a situation, learning how, okay, what can I control in it and what can't I control in it? And let me focus on what I can control.
Does it seem like, as a species, as humans, that we're almost more, without really thinking about it, that we're almost more drawn to hopelessness?
Negative bias is I think
yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, because that's the another thing. It's like, you scan the environment for threats and then you hold on to those threats. And then, you know, it's a response that we used to use to protect us. Like that's what we did when we lived in the jungle or wherever we lived, you know?
Yeah.
So, but do we need that now? But that's like the news. That's why the news can be so damaging, because they really capitalize on that. Just
reinforces the fears.
Oh yeah. It's all negative headlines. We're just clicking and clicking and clicking. And then it's like, everything is overwhelming. It trains us to hopelessness, but really they're just taking advantage of how our brains are wired. So once we kind of understand that, and okay, no, not everything's negative, but that's just how they position it, because that's how they make their money from their ad dollars. And you know, with the kids, teens, we're like, you know, set up some guidelines for yourself so that you're not like feeding into that, and you're learning just, you know, that's how it's set up, and you can, it's kind of more fun than anything else. And then limit your exposure to news, because that's not really how the world is. It's just how they make money, and that's how our brains work. So we want to see what's wrong so we can protect ourselves, but it's not, you know, really helpful. Most of the things in the news, yeah, we have no power or control over anyway. So it's just really cycling that hopelessness. So yeah. And then attaching to outcomes is another big challenge. When we get too attached to the outcome, you know, when we have goals or hopes, it's really, we want the feeling associated with that. So if we can focus more on the feeling, and when we can't achieve that goal, kind of rethink of, well, what other thing can I do that can produce that feeling? Like when I lost my dad, I wanted my dad. I was so attached to that and having my dad, you know, throughout my whole life. And But learning how to, how, like, what feelings did he bring, and what other people could I bring into my life that could bring that feeling? And like, that was Paul Carter here in Northwest Arkansas. He was like a father-like figure to me and that family. And so how I could, how could I spend more time with them so I could get that connection, that mentorship, that, you know, so it's, and it's, you know, these are all things that we need to be taught. We don't know it intuitively. We're not taught generally in school. And these are things that I learned that are critical to our hope.
Which is why your program and the, for the different age groups is so invaluable.
Thank you. Yeah. And I'm so passionate about, I mean, I think that we can prevent suicide, totally.
And your book on hope?
Yeah.
I meant to have it here in front of me. What's the title?
The Biggest Little Book About Hope.
The Biggest Little Book About Hope.
Yes. So I was, I wrote it when I was living in Reno, which is the biggest little city in the world.
I wondered where the title came from.
I know, yeah. So I was like, you know, Reno was the first hopeful city. That's where we kind of birthed it. And I thought, what should I name my book? And I thought, The Biggest Little Book About Hope. And then my advisor, I sent it to my advisor to read. And he's like, you should name it, Dr. Belfer, my love, Myron, thank you. He's like, you should name it The Biggest Little Big Book. He's like, you know, but yeah, just, you know, so that I can share what I know. I mean, I feel so fortunate to have learned from, I mean, I'm a rep at the UN for the World Federation for Mental Health. I've been attending the World Health Organization's MHGAP Forum for many years. I've been learning from all of these brilliant scientists and experts and happiness and mental health and these leading hope experts. And I just feel so fortunate. I'm like, how can I condense this? And you know, I'm a marketing and branding person, and package it in a way where people can remember it and practice it and learn without having to go through everything I went through to get the information and to learn and to practice myself. So that's really, that's my aim and goal.
You're using your marketing and branding skills for good.
Yes, I am. Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I learned so much too from Sam Walton growing up and his principles. And he has a quote, lose your smile, lose your customer. And I feel like he knew all along, you know, just like the importance of that. And to me, the smile represents, it's kind of a symbol for hope. And it's,
I'm going to remember that about the mirror.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
What's amazing. That cliche of turn that frown upside down.
I know, which I found so annoying. And then I'm like, I should have listened to it. You know, oftentimes the thing that like annoy us the most are the things we need to kind of open our minds and hearts to. And so learning how to do that, and it served me so well. You know, hope isn't about some like you're happy all the time. It's about really, really honoring your feelings and your states of where you are, but learning better ways to manage them, manage the challenges of life that are part of every day of everything we live.
A couple words that just pop into my head is resiliency and choices.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep.
Well, this has been amazing.
Aww.
I don't even know time-wise where we're at. I think it's been a while.
Yeah, and so, probably.
Yeah, well, we'll have to do part two then.
So. Awesome, I love it.
I feel like we could keep talking. So,
I want to activate the whole region, Northwest Arkansas, for anyone that wants to support in that effort. I really want to ensure everyone in this region knows what hopelessness is and has the skills and knowledge to activate and find their way to hope. It's my goal.
Well, I'm excited to share this podcast with my students and my whole LinkedIn community.
Thank you so much for your time. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to Chatting About Change with Dr. Jim Maddox. If you want to connect more, you can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and at my website, drjimmaddox.com. Thanks for listening.